It's nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT. On 100.1 FM, it's your public radio station, broadcasting from cloudy Kodiak, Alaska, where we are seeing 48 degrees under light rain. We've actually lost a couple of degrees in the last hour. They're calling for rain for the rest of the day, at least before 4 p.m., high near 49 today. South wind 15, gusting as high as 25. Mostly cloudy skies tonight, gradually becoming mostly clear overnight with a low around 44. The winds turning to the west, gusting as high as 30 tonight. They're also calling for mostly sunny skies tomorrow, high near 51. Coming up on the Midday Report, legislators will be tested at the Capitol again for COVID. Also, Alaska's municipal government has paid nearly $30 million for coronavirus testing. Those contracts are about to expire. And we have preliminary results from the local election. Those stories, plus a new Learjet for Alaska's medevac provider, after this.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. A vote on suspending the debt limit, which was expected this hour, is on hold. The Senate's top two leaders are talking through a proposal that Republican leader Mitch McConnell put forward with less than 2 weeks to go before the U.S. runs out of cash reserves. McConnell suggested one option was for the GOP to agree to an expedited reconciliation process that would get the debt ceiling raised but not suspended by October 18th. Option two, let the Democrats use normal procedures to pass an emergency debt limit extension at a fixed dollar amount covering current spending levels through December. Either way, Republicans are working this in such a way that Democrats will likely find their options limited in terms of following through on President Biden's domestic spending agenda. In ratcheting up pressure on Republicans, Biden met today with some of the nation's top financial leaders to help. Here's NPR's Asma Khalid.
The president pointed out that Republicans have raised the debt limit multiple times before, including three times under former President Trump. But Republicans say they don't want to assist in Democrats' quote, reckless spending plans. The president says that's not the issue here.
Let me be clear. Raising the debt limit is paying our old debts. There's nothing to do with new spending or what may be coming this year or other years. There's nothing to do with my plans on infrastructure or building back better.
In fact, the two are not entirely unrelated. If Congress doesn't act, it's estimated the government won't be able to pay its bills after October 18th. Asma Khalid, NPR News, The White House.
An 18-year-old student suspected in a shooting at a Dallas area school is now in police custody. Bill Zeeble of member station KERA has the latest.
Officials say four people were injured and three were taken to the hospital after the shooting at Timberview High School. Another person with minor injuries declined treatment. Arlington police began getting calls about the shooting at around 9:15. The school was immediately locked down and students and staff stayed in classrooms and offices for much of the morning. Arlington Assistant Police Chief Kevin Colby says officials believe a fight at the school led to the shooting. I'm Bill Zeeble in Dallas.
Pope Francis says he is saddened and ashamed that the Roman Catholic Church has failed to do more to shield children from sexual predators. NPR's Sylvia Poggioli reports on the pontiff's remarks a day after a French investigation that revealed abuses committed by clergy and lay workers over 70 years against hundreds of thousands of children.
The Pope spoke of his sorrow for the pain and trauma the victims have suffered, and his voice cracked when he added, "I express my shame and our shame over the Church's too long inability to put the victims at the center of its concerns." The 2,500-page report was put together by an independent commission and shows that most of the victims were boys between the ages of 10 and 13.
That's NPR's Sylvia Poggioli reporting from Rome. The Dow closes up more than 100 points. You're listening to NPR News.
Ang NPR Balita ay hatid sa inyo ng Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. Para sa kaukulang impormasyon tungkol sa aming mga serbisyo, tumawag lamang sa 481-2400.
Unofficial returns from Tuesday showed Scott Smiley take a commanding lead in his bid for a seat on the Kodiak Island Borough Assembly. He reportedly received more votes than both incumbents to likely unseat Assemblymember Dennis Simmons. Incumbent James Turner came in second in the five-way race for two seats, with Simmons taking third place. Sarah Sunston and Eric Sunston came in fourth and fifth, respectively. Kodiak City Council results are less clear. As of Tuesday evening, Rich Walker is projected to be re-elected, but the second seat is in a dead heat between KMXT host and incumbent Terry Haynes and Tracy Craig. With no challenger, Pat Branson was re-elected as city mayor for another three-year term. In other races, David Johnson and Judy Karstens were re-elected for school board, fending off write-in challenger Tammy Holforty. Paul Van Dyke returns to Fire Protection Area No. 1 board. He'll be joined by John Parker, who pulled ahead of Scott Arndt. Paul Hansen and Jay Baldwin took two seats on the Service Area No. 1 board, running uncontested. Jacob Castanguay won one of two seats on the Women's Bay Road Service Area, running uncontested as a write-in candidate. That leaves the extra Women's Bay Service Area seat, two seats on the Bayview Road Service Area board, two seats on the Mission Lake Tide Gate Service Area board, and two seats on the Menashka Bay Road Service Area board to be decided by appointment by the Borough Assembly. These are early results for the elections. For ongoing coverage of this election, stay tuned to KMXT 100.1 FM.
Legislators and others who work in the Capitol will again be required to be tested for COVID-19 regularly. The Legislative Council, which is responsible for the Capitol, updated its COVID-19 safety policy yesterday in response to the recent surge in cases. Juneau Democratic Representative Sarah Hannon is the council's chair. She says the update will improve safety while minimizing costs.
I feel like it is a step in the right direction and contemplates the movement of people who are regularly coming in and out of the building.
The updated policy requires those who work in the Capitol to be tested every 4 days and to isolate if they test positive. The new policy doesn't affect members of the public who are required to wear a mask in the Capitol and to screen themselves for symptoms before entering the building. The council voted 10-3 in favor of the testing. Eagle River Senator Laura Reinbold was among the no votes.
We are constitutionally required to be at the Capitol, and I don't want to be put in a box where I'm not allowed to represent people if I don't follow something, you know, such as encycling testing every 4 days to access the Capitol. I think this is about the most unconstitutional thing I've ever seen.
Reinbold has been banned by Alaska Airlines for refusing to wear a mask. The new policy will not require those who work in the Capitol to provide proof that they have been tested. The council considered reinstituting screening at the door to verify that people have been tested, but the members decided against it, noting both the cost and the possibility that lawmakers may not spend much time in the Capitol this special session, which must end by November 2nd. The next floor sessions are scheduled for Friday. The municipal government of Anchorage has paid nearly $30 million to the company that runs its coronavirus testing and vaccine sites. Now those contracts are about to expire. As Nat Herz with Alaska Public Media reports, Mayor Dave Bronson's administration says city-sponsored vaccines and tests will continue, but it's not yet clear in what form.
If you've gotten a COVID test or vaccine in Anchorage recently, chances are the company that provided it was Visit Healthcare. Visit has been running vaccination sites at places like the Northway Mall and the Diamond Center. It also does testing at the Lusac Library, Change Point Church, and Muldoon Community Assembly. The California-based company has done testing in California, Illinois, and Texas, and it's had a presence in Anchorage for more than a year. But its contracts with the city run out at the end of the month, and Mayor Dave Bronson's administration says it's evaluating whether different testing and vaccination strategies could better serve the city's needs. Bronson, a conservative, was sworn in July after playing down the pandemic on the campaign trail. But his health director says there's no intention of phasing out the city's role in testing and vaccination. It's possible Visit's contracts could be extended, or the city could move in a different direction, officials say. The health department wants to avoid overlap with other testing sites operated by the state, so it could choose to move some of its clinics around. The health department has given 4 testing and vaccination options for Bronson to choose from with different sized programs. Before the city can pay for whichever option the mayor chooses, assembly members will have to approve it at a meeting before the end of the month. Visit officials did not respond to requests for comment. In Anchorage, I'm Nat Herz.
A Juneau man has been missing for more than a week. Family and friends have been posting on social media and searching for Douglas Farnsworth for several days. Juneau Police Detective Craig Campbell says the department assigned a detective to Farnsworth's case on October 1st. That's when the detective talked to his family and found out that Farnsworth was driving someone else's truck, which was found near the Perseverance trailhead.
That in itself was just unusual because the keys were left in it. There were some personal items belonging to Mr. Farnsworth in it.
After the truck was found, Juneau Police contacted the Alaska State Troopers to launch a search.
But they didn't think he was out, like, hiking or anything. There was reasons to believe that, he wasn't doing that. But maybe he had gone into the woods and may need some assistance in getting back.
The troopers and a local canine search group called Sea Dogs were searching near downtown on Friday and Saturday. On Saturday morning, the Coast Guard was doing flyovers of downtown in a helicopter looking for Farnsworth. But Campbell says they didn't find any trace of him, and Sea Dogs didn't pick up a scent.
Then you're just kind of blindly searching in the woods, and it's just such a huge area to cover. That's not something they're typically doing.
So for now, Campbell says troopers have called off their active search, though he says they can start it up again if they get new information. He says the police department still has a detective on the case who is investigating it. Farnsworth was contacted by Juneau Police on September 27th about a misdemeanor driving under the influence charge. But Campbell says he doesn't think that's the last time anyone saw Farnsworth. He says they got a report that someone saw Farnsworth driving in town on the 28th. Farnsworth's sister, who goes by Kiki Dawn, is traveling to Juneau from out of town. She says it's not normal for him to vanish from social media. He's prolific on TikTok, where he has nearly 11,000 followers. She says he wasn't an avid camper or hiker. Campbell says anyone who knows something about Farnsworth's disappearance can contact 586-0600 or make an anonymous report to Juneau's crime line. Remote communities and limited hospital facilities make medevacs a fact of life for many in Alaska. One of Alaska's medevac providers recently upgraded its fleet with a larger, faster jet that has more room for patients and their loved ones. Coast Alaska's Jacob Resnick checked it out.
Pilot Sam Steensland's office has 7,000 pounds of thrust.
All right, engineer choice.
We're not going anywhere, but Steensland wanted to show off his Learjet 45XR's avionics and help me get some sound of an engine firing up on the tarmac of Juneau's airport.
Will that work, or should we get another one going?
That's running? That's really quiet.
I know it is.
Yeah. It's like my Nissan Leaf.
Exactly. Pretty nice, isn't it?
This is Airlift Northwest's newest aircraft. It replaces a slightly smaller Learjet.
Just as fast as our old jet, but it carries a lot more fuel. The nurses have a lot more room in the back to work. The avionics up front are a lot nicer. So I'd say just about everything about it's a lot nicer.
It's not uncommon for a patient in Southeast Alaska to be medevaced to a larger hospital, usually in Anchorage or Seattle. But a few communities have runways too short to land a jet.
We can't do Skagway or Hoonah in the jet. And that's why we have our turboprop can do those.
The turboprops are common, but they fly lower and slower and are more limited by the elements. There are also some situations where planes can't land at all. For example, Angoon on Admiralty Island doesn't have an airport, or a patient might need extracting from the deck of a fishing boat, or there's a lost hunter in the wilderness. In cases like these, they're often evacuated by the Coast Guard, which has rescue helicopters based in Sitka and Kodiak.
And the Coast Guard helicopter will actually land right beside our plane. We'll transfer the patient onto our plane and off we go to wherever they need to get to.
Inside the Learjet's cabin, there's a long stretcher where an injured or ill patient is secured. There are seats for the 2 flight nurses and even extra space for up to 3 family members. Elise Blasco, the Juno base manager for Airlift Northwest, says the aircraft is stocked with medications, equipment for blood transfusions, and monitors to provide the patient with intensive care.
We are a flying ICU, so everything that you're going to find in an ICU, we're going to have the capabilities to initiate or continue in this aircraft as well.
Stabilizing patients is essential because a flight between Juneau and Seattle can take more than 2 hours while cruising at more than 500 miles an hour. Diana Paul is a flight nurse who says the newest jet is an upgrade for everyone on board.
It has a lot more headspace, so the patients are a lot more comfortable. Before, it was pretty tight and they'd feel a little claustrophobic, so this is really a lot more comfortable for the patients and us, and it has a lot more fuel range so we can go further.
Airlift Northwest charges by the mile, and a flight to Seattle can cost around $100,000. An hour and 20-minute trip up to Anchorage is at least $70,000. The providers bill insurance companies first, but patients sometimes find their insurer won't pay the full amount, says Shelley Deering.
I cannot emphasize enough that it's really important for Alaskans to look at what their insurance covers for Medevac to make sure that they are covered.
She handles the billing for Airlift Northwest, the nonprofit that's an arm of the University of Washington. She says some insurance plans cover more than others.
So it's good to check your insurance to see what it does cover.
There are three Medevac providers in Southeast Alaska, two of which are for-profit enterprises. All three offer an annual membership plan. That means households that are enrolled won't be billed for anything their insurance company won't cover. She says sometimes people sign up from a hospital bed while waiting to fly.
But you have to be awake or have someone as an advocate who can do that for you.
So it's good to do your homework ahead of time, because you may not get to it if you're a Medevac patient being treated at 41,000 feet. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
In Anchorage, more than 70 people experiencing homelessness have died outside in the last 4 years. That's according to reporting by the Anchorage Daily News, which found that the majority of outdoor deaths were from hypothermia, complications of chronic alcoholism, or drug overdoses. As ADN reporter Michelle Turbo Boots told Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove, the deaths have gone mostly unnoticed by Anchorage residents in recent years.
We knew that outdoor deaths were happening. My colleague Paula Dobbin had done some reporting on that, just about how quietly they continue to happen year in and year out without really the public knowing much about them. But what we hadn't known, and also what policymakers and the nonprofit world service providers hadn't known, is exactly what people were dying of.
I mean, some of us will remember in the past, an outdoor death like this would trigger like a press release from the police department, and that's no longer the case, right?
Right. You know, back in 2009, 2010, there was a really highly publicized series of outdoor deaths that it was kind of a turning point for the community. They received high levels of media coverage. There were, community meetings about them, even some action, changes in how cold weather shelter was provided, because people were learning about and hearing about homeless people dying outside on the streets. And, Anchorage found that intolerable. And then no one seems to really quite know why, but the practice of publicly reporting those outdoor deaths just kind of fell away. And so it's been a very unknown, underknown phenomenon.
There were a few different steps that you had to go through to kind of get this information. And could you describe that?
So what I had from the combinations of our efforts was a list of 74 names from 2017 until now. And I had a short narrative of each death, where the person was found, whether anything suspicious was found, any other, major details, and the person's name and age. And the real question I had was, well, what are these folks dying from? And could these deaths have been prevented? And then I was by chance having a conversation with our Alaska State Medical Examiner, Dr. Gary Zintek, about something completely different. And he said, well, how many names do you have? And I said, well, 74. And he said, if you send me those names, that's a large enough number that I could send you back an aggregate of the causes of death without identifying specific people. So after, a couple of days, he got back to me with that data. And for, the first time in a while, we had a much clearer picture of what the causes of death are for unhoused people who die on the street.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. I'm looking at the graphic that Kevin Powell put together for you guys at the Anchorage Daily News, and there's, you know, certainly drug overdoses and complications involving alcoholism are close to the top, but the actual most deaths were caused by hypothermia, just being outside in the cold, right?
Yeah, and I think that's both a shocking and not surprising number. I mean, I think it's tragic and shocking. And though, you know, we do live in a subarctic climate where we all know that the harsh winter is a major danger, I think what's so surprising about that is there is a perception among some people that we have systems in place to keep this from happening. And I think that people are shocked by that number, that 17 people have died of the cold on the streets of Anchorage in the last 5 years, because I think we like to think we're better than that as a community, that we have somehow solved that or put systems in place to keep that from happening. And what this shows is that, no, we haven't solved that. People are still dying of hypothermia on the streets of Anchorage every year.
So with the social services folks that work with people experiencing homelessness, what did they say about this, other than, you know, that it is tragic that folks would die of hypothermia out in the cold? Do they say that this is useful, that they might have practical applications for using this information?
The feedback I've heard is that, you know, policymakers are really glad to know this. But I think it also just points to a much more complex problem, right? So, you know, hypothermia deaths, the medical examiner said alcohol contributes to almost all of those. We also have, you know, complications of chronic alcoholism, drug overdoses, acute alcohol intoxication as the top four causes of death, which really points to a need to address addiction and substance misuse as an urgent priority, it seems like.
I guess, you know, Michelle, on a personal level, what's it like to read these narratives of each of these people's deaths?
It's really heartbreaking. And I think one element is just how familiar and public the places that people have died are. You know, I drive down one section of Minnesota Drive 3 or 4 times a week. And right there, a woman about my age died right there on the sidewalk this year. And it's just, I think knowing more about these deaths, you have to see the city in a different way.
That was Anchorage Daily News reporter Michelle Tiro Boots talking to Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove. You can read the full story about outdoor deaths at adn.com.
Today's KMXT Local News is brought to you in part by Discover Kodiak, a one-stop source for visitor information on Kodiak and other destinations around the state. On the web at kodiak.org and at the Visitor Center in the Ferry Terminal Building at 100 Marine Way, 486-4782.
This is Alaska Fish Radio. I'm Lainey Welch. How clean are your local harbor waters? More on a call for feedback after this.
This radio is brought to you by Alaska Boats and Permits in Homer, marine broker for vessels, permits, and IFQs, online at alaskaboat.com.
Are your local harbor waters clean? Are there sewage pumpouts and adequate disposal stations for trash and debris? Do Alaskans even notice or care? Two quick surveys for boaters and communities aim to find out.
So we want to get as much input from all of Alaska as possible. We want to hear from boat users in the harbors, as well as community members, as well as we'll be doing a survey for harbor masters as well and harbor staff.
Tav Amu is a Bristol Bay fisherman and Alaska Sea Grant Fellow. He's getting feedback on how they perceive water quality in local harbors. Disposal of sewage called black water is a top concern. There's a scarcity or no pump-out stations in most Alaska harbors, and Amu says many boaters don't use good disposal practices.
Probably half of the people I talked to already had marine sanitation devices on board. They just weren't being utilized. And so that was kind of an aha moment for me, that it's not that people aren't interested or aware, it's just that they don't have options necessarily. They have the MSDs and the capability, but they don't use them.
MSDs are marine sanitation devices. The surveys will let Alaskans pinpoint problems and offer solutions.
Hopefully, through the survey, people have the opportunity to bring up other issues that they see are problems, and so we can identify what else we need to focus on. Yeah, cigarette butts, or I know in Bristol Bay, at the end of the season, there's just plastic debris floating all over the place. I know a couple fishermen who just go around at the end of the season and fill up garbage bag after garbage bag of just trash floating around.
Amu will discuss the survey results at the Alaska Harbor Masters Conference later this month in Anchorage. Find links to the surveys at alaskafishradio.com and on Facebook. Fish Radio is also brought to you by OBI Seafoods, serving Alaska's fishing communities since 1910. In Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
KMXT is awaiting a new announcement from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game here in Kodiak. To hear the most recent announcement regarding openings and closures around Kodiak, call 486-4559.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Kodiak Public Health invites community members to Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine clinics September 29th and 30th and October 6th, 7th, and 8th from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. at the Kodiak High School Auditorium at 722 Mill Bay Road. Everyone age 12 and up is eligible to receive the first or second dose of the Pfizer vaccine. Booster doses are approved for people who are immune compromised, at high risk for severe COVID, or anyone 65 and up. A message from the Department of Health and Social Services. Those clinics starting today, or this week. Welcome to your Island Messenger for Wednesday. It is the sixth day of October, the year 2021. The sun rose today at 8:25. It will set again at 7:28. That will give us 11 hours and 3 minutes of daylight, a loss of 4 minutes and 55 seconds compared to yesterday. So it looks like we're turning back the other way. It was 4:56 yesterday. Looking at our local tides, we have a high tide coming up at 2:36 this afternoon for our east side. That will be a 9.5-foot tide, followed by a low tide at 8:48 p.m. of minus 6/10 of a foot. Our next high tide will be at 3:02 a.m. and be 9 feet, and our low tide for the morning on the east side will be at 8:57 a.m., almost 9 a.m., and be 0.1 of a foot. Over on the west side, you have a high tide coming up at 3:09 p.m., a 16-foot tide in Larson Bay, followed by a low tide at 9:28 p.m. of minus 1.6 feet. Your next high tide will be at 3:33 a.m. and be 15.4 feet, and your low tide for tomorrow morning on the west side will be at 9:38 in the morning and be minus 0.5 feet in Larson Bay. Mariners, you have a small craft advisory through Thursday from Marmot Island to Sitkanak. South wind at 25 knots now, seas to 7 feet. For tomorrow, west 25, seas to 7 feet. Over in the Shelikof, small craft advisory through Thursday as well. South 25 right now on the Shelikof, seas to 7 feet. For tomorrow, west 25, seas coming down to 6 feet in the Shelikof. KMXT's virtual Run the Rock is this weekend, featuring a marathon, half marathon, 10K, 5K. You can pick the distance you want to run and the day and time you want to run, so you can kind of pick your weather. Register for the race of your choice on kmxt.org. And you can run any time between Saturday, October 9th, through 11 p.m. on Monday, October 11th. And again, just register on kmxt.org. You get a T-shirt for registering. And anyone who finishes the race, any one of these races, gets a bag o' bling. Friday, October 8th at the library from 2 to 4 p.m., they will host a garden party. Come help plant bulbs and prepare the library garden for winter. So that's this Friday, 2 to 4 p.m. at the public library. They're having their garden party.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 3 times a day. Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the midday report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.